time to unleash your inner cowboy with the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Now, here's your host, Alyssa Barnes.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode number 12 of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Many of you are probably familiar with my guest today. Alex Cord is a horseman, an author, a stage actor, and a movie star. He appeared in more than 30 films, including several westerns and 300 television shows. Perhaps most notably, he played Archangel on the hit series Airwolf. Now, even if you are familiar with Alex's acting career, you may not be aware that he is also an avid horseman and he's competed in many different disciplines in the horse world, including cutting, polo, team roping, even fox hunting. He has an autobiography coming out early next year, and based on what I learned about his life in this interview, it sounds like a must read. Now, just in case you missed the announcements I made in last week's episode, I'm going to touch on them real briefly before we get started. First of all, I just want to remind everyone that Earn Your Spurs t-shirts, hoodies, and long sleeve t-shirts are available. Just go to earnyourspurs.com and you can click on the link right there on the homepage. The shirts are part of a Teespring campaign, so they'll only be available for a couple more weeks. Also, if you weren't able to attend the PBR and pick up your Earn Your Spurs auto sticker that my brother was handing out down there, you can get those by leaving me a review in iTunes and then taking a screenshot of your review and emailing it to me at Alyssa@earnyourspurs.com. If you send me that screenshot along with your address, I will get one mailed out to you right away. Lastly, I'm going to be launching a new podcast called Cowboy Q&A. It'll be a shorter format podcast and it will be based on the questions I get from you guys. So if you have any questions about cowboy culture or the Western lifestyle, please go to earnyourspurs.com, click on the Cowboy Q&A tab, and you can leave me a voicemail right there on the website. If I happen to choose your question, your voicemail will air right on the podcast episode. And I just might send you something cool as a thank you for sending in your question. Thank you for being here, and let's go ahead and talk to Alex Cord. I understand that you are involved in cutting horses.
Oh, I have been for many years, but it's been a unique way for me because I have never actually owned a cutting horse.
Oh, really?
But I've been a serious horseman all my life, and I've studied with some of the best people in the world. I played professional polo for 20 years. I've shown jumpers. I'm a team roper. And I've won. Well, let me back up a minute. As a celebrity, I got involved with Ben Johnson, who was a dear friend of mine. We did a couple of movies together. And
yeah. We
did these pro celebrity rodeos for 16 years, and we did as many as five and six a year, mostly in Texas, but California, Colorado, Arizona. And that's where I had been playing polo when I got invited to join that family. And The two things that they had going, well, they had three. They had cutting, team penning, and team roping. Mm. And I was not a roper, so I got into the penning. That was easy for me. And then they asked me if I would like to ride a cutting horse. And I said, sure, I've never done it, you know. And the next thing I know, I've got one of the best cutters in the world coaching me, a guy named Leon Harrell. And that was my first experience was with Leon Harrell and then Bobby Hunt. And Leon put me on one of his horses. And the first time, I'll never forget it because in polo and jumping, everything else I'd ever done on a horse. It's all going forward and going fast. And in polo, I mean, you don't even wait for the horse. You have to go left. You go left and hope that the horse is going to be under you sometime. So in cutting is just the opposite. Here I am on a horse and the guy is telling me to throw the reins away. And there's a huge loop in the reins. Put your hand down and trust the horse and ride the stop. I couldn't believe it when I threw those reins away and that horse started to cut that cow. Of course, it was a great horse. It was one of Leon Harrell's horses. And I managed to stay on. I got a grin on my face that was there for a week. I've never had so much fun on a horse. And so that's how it started. And then I live in Texas, and the futurity was going on in Fort Worth. And I got invited to participate in that as a celebrity cutter. And they got a bunch of good, you know, people who could ride, who were celebrities. Angel Cordero was one of them. And he's a guy, a jockey, who won the Kentucky Derby about at least three times that I know of. So, you know, anyway, I go in there on another one of Leon Harrell's horses, and I won the thing, and I got the Jim Reno trophy.
Wow.
A beautiful bronze trophy. So I got that and a Gary Gist buckle. So
awesome.
Then I go back next year, and I was the reigning champion. And the same thing. I won it again the second time. And then I'll cut right to the chase here. I go back the third year and I won it again on a different horse.
Oh,
every
my God.
Time. They quit inviting me after that. And I got pissed off. I wrote them a letter. I said, I thought this was supposed to be a sport. How can you not invite the reigning champion back? Well, we want to give somebody else a chance. I said, well, hey, I don't come here with my own stinger. I get on whatever you guys give me to ride.
Right.
So, you know, if you don't want me to win, you know, give me a crippled horse that won't win. You know, whatever. Anyway, so that's my, and you know, so I've, oh, and Larry Mahan is a really good pal of mine, and he was seriously into cutting. So I'd go out to his place and we'd cut, and I'd go to Bobby Hunt's place. So I got invited everywhere to go and ride great cutting horses, and I've never had to own one.
Well, that's not too shabby.
No, I mean, there are, you know, one of the perks of being a so-called celebrity, it does have its advantages.
Well, that's awesome. I grew up showing cutting horses, so I know how addicting it can be. And it's actually kind of surprising that you never bought one because of that.
Well, the only reason I didn't buy one is I really couldn't afford to get into it. Polo was so expensive, you know, and I was really addicted to polo. And
yeah.
So there you've got to have, you know, six horses. And so that was it. My focus was more on the polo. And then early on in the that 16-year period, they needed a roper at one point, and I couldn't rope. I'd never roped. I didn't know anything about it. But here was my dear friend Ben Johnson, who was a world's champion steer roper, back as well as an Academy Award winner. And they needed a roper one day, and they said, "Alex, they knew that I was a good rider." And so Gary Gist, who makes the buckles, the mm-hmm. best in the world. He was a very good roper, and they wanted me to heel. And at first they said, you can be tied on so you don't have to worry about dallying and all that. So I had Ben Johnson and Gary Gist showing me. I spent a few hours with them on one day before the roping. It showed me how to throw a heel loop, you know, around a wooden horse with the legs lifted off the ground. And I went out there the next day and roped. And I sure didn't win, but I did catch. And I was tied on, and I didn't have to dally. But I never liked being tied on, but I did get addicted to roping big time. Mm. And then so I learned how to dally and all of that. So I roped a lot. I've had some really great rope horses. So,
well, that's awesome. You've had a lot of different experiences in the horse world.
Oh, God. I was a whipper-in with a fox hunting club for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I you know what it is, Alyssa? I knew that I'd never be great at anything in my life. But I've always been a serious student, and I always wanted to be as good as I could be at whatever I decided that I wanted to do. And way back, I decided that I wanted to become the best all-around horseman that I could. And I set out to do that, and that's been my life's goal. And I'm still working at it. Every day. I'm not writing books. Lately, I've been obsessed with a book that I'm writing. But if I'm not actually involved in writing a book, I do ride almost every day. And I've studied with some of the best people and spent very serious time riding with only the best in every discipline. And, you know, like I say, I've never been great at any of it, but I'm pretty damn good at cutting, and I was a pretty good roper. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just an average polo player.
Well, that's a crazy sport. I mean, it's amazing how much is actually going on out there on the field at one time.
Oh, well, you know, you're so right. People have no idea. I mean, as I say, I can speak from serious experience in so many disciplines. And to me, there's nothing like polo. Polo stands mm-hmm. alone. In fact, I wrote a line about it once. How did I... You have to ride like a Comanche. You have to think like a chess player in a fraction of a second. You have to hit a ball with the accuracy of Tiger Woods, and ball is never where you want it to be. And you've got four other guys trying to break your kneecaps. That's what polo is.
That's a pretty vivid description.
Yeah, I wrote that. I remember it because it's been quoted a few times in different interviews and stuff. So I have another good line that might interest you that is my own. And it is, there is a potent, influential energy that comes from within the horse, and those who fall under its spell are the slaves of a grand passion.
Wow, that's pretty powerful for anybody who understands that.
Yeah. My wife is a professional dressage trainer, and she does classical dressage, not modern. Mm. Not the stuff that's going on. There's a lot of stuff in dressage today that is deplorable, absolutely deplorable. But she doesn't do that. She's part of a unique group that maintain classical dressage. And I've been taking lessons from her.
Oh, wow.
In dressage. And I bought her a horse about 10 years ago that was just a colt. And she wanted a big horse. And I found a draft cross it was a paint Clydesdale cross. And this is one lovely creature. And he is now still among us. And she's very tall. She's 6 feet tall. So she rides him and has brought him along as a dressage horse. And the picture of the two of them together is unbelievable. And he's a flashy tri-colored paint, but looks like a Clydesdale. He looks like he could be pulling the Budweiser wagon. He's just magnificent. And she said, but the reason I brought him up is the power of the horse is such that this horse, you know how important the look in the eye is of a horse. Mm-hmm. If you're going to buy a horse, I mean, that's one of the first things, apart from looking at their feet and legs, is their eye. And I can look in this horse's eye, and I am transported. It's like a meditation. Just looking in his eye takes me to some wonderfully mysterious place. And I get choked up talking about it because I'll stand in front of him. And he'll hang his head over the stall. He's just so full of love. And I stroke his face a little, and I just look into that eye. And it's like being hypnotized. I just I go to another place. Yeah.
Yeah, horses are definitely special in that way. And I'm curious, Alex, how you originally got started with horses as a kid and sort of that path that led you down the road to pretty much exploring everything there is to do with them at some point in your life.
Well, it's very simple. I was 2 years old, and I'm so old that when I was 2 years old, we had milk that was delivered by a horse-drawn cart. And this guy park in front of our little house, and then the horse would just stand there like a statue, and he would get out and carry the milk, which came in bottles with the cream separate on top. And a little cardboard lid that stuck in the bottle. And I was sitting on the front steps of the house with two or three other guys. And we were all 2 and 3 year old kids. And we were sitting looking at the horse. And one of the kids said, "I dare you to go down there and touch that horse's foot." And he said that to the other, to me and the other guy. I think it was three of us. And no, the other guy wasn't about to go down there. And I didn't hesitate at all. I jumped up and I just went down there, put my hand flat on the hoof. And then the next thing I knew, I was stroking up his leg to his knee. And then back down. And then I walked over to his head. And his head was about just kind of a level, normal position. But it was too high up and I couldn't reach him. And I just stood there looking up at him. And he lowered his head. And I touched his nose. And that was the start, right? That was the start. I was born with it. I just love with that horse and any horse. And then there was a guy who used to come around our neighborhood with a little string of ponies. and he charged 10 cents a ride for three rides for a quarter. And you'd go up the block and back. That was one ride. And it used to come every Friday afternoon in the summer, about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'd be sitting out there clutching my dime or quarter, whichever I had earned. I could help my mother do some stuff. And they were struggling. I mean, this was during the Depression. The times were very tough. But I always managed to get at least a dime. And then after I had my ride on the pony, I would hang out there until they left, or just hanging out in the middle of that little group of five ponies or whatever it was. And that was it. I mean, all summer, every summer, when other kids were playing baseball and football, I was down at the local livery stable shoveling manure. They would let me ride. And that you know, so it's just been a constant throughout my life. And when I was 16 years old, I worked at a summer job, and I bought a horse for $150 and kept him at this local livery stable. That was like 1948. Yeah. You're familiar with the magazine Western Horseman?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you know that I have had a subscription to Western Horseman since 1949?
Wow.
And of course, I still have it. And I have about, I think maybe 8 or 10 copies, not in complete succession, but I have one or two from 1949. And a couple from 1952, 53. You know, I've got, I think, about 8 or 10, and they're in a couple of binders. In fact, I'm looking up at a bookshelf here, and they're up on the top shelf of in this wine-colored binder. So, and now I just, about 8 months ago, I had to quit roping because I had to put down two really good rope horses. One had got that EPM, and it was fatal. And I spent thousands trying to save his life. And it's happened to me twice, once in California and once here in Texas. And I just, and I thought, man, I've been roping for about 20 years, and I've still got all my fingers. And my back has given me a lot of trouble. So I just thought, it's probably time for me to quit while I'm ahead and not want to go through the whole process of looking for another rope horse. And I've always been fascinated by the rejoneadores, the guys who fight the bulls on horseback. I've seen it a couple of times in Portugal and Spain, and it's not, I'm totally against normal bullfighting. I think it's torture. And what they do is cruel to the bull. They take away his weapons. The picadors do. They poke lances into the shoulder. And so the bull is, you know, it doesn't have a chance. But in the Rejoneo, it's a whole other thing, man. And I strongly suggest that you go on YouTube and find some, they've got tons of videos, and and you look up Portugal, Lusitanos is what you want to find.
Okay.
That's the horse, the breed they use. And it's just like an Andalusian.
Right.
The Andalusian's from Spain and the Lusitano is from Portugal.
I see.
And I bought one about 8 months ago. And so I'm taking dressage lessons from Susanna on my Lusitano. days.
That is very cool. I actually have a friend who has an Andalusian stud, and she does dressage and 3-day eventing and all that on him. But she also can rope on him and brand on him, and he's very versatile, and I really like that about him.
Oh, then they're so athletic.
Mm-hmm.
Man, there's I think he died now, but there is a video on a Palomino Lusitano, which is very rare. And it's, what's the famous name of a magician from King Arthur's time? He's a wizard.
Merlin.
Merlin. That's exactly right. And okay, you look up Merlin the Lusitano on YouTube, and you will not believe. I mean, these guys make a cutting horse look like he's tied to a post. I mean, it's unbelievable what they do. Not canter, but gallop sideways.
Mm.
Bull's horns are 3 inches away from the bull, and the matador, or the juniador, is hanging off with his hat in his hand and touching the bull's face with it while the horse is galloping sideways.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
That does sound amazing.
Yeah.
So, Alex, you got started in rodeo as a teenager. How did that come about?
Well, I wanted to be a jockey when I was a kid because I was born near Belmont Racetrack. And I used to ride my bike over to the racetrack and hide in the weeds and climb over the fence. And I'd be right in the tall grass right next to the exercise tracks. And I could sit there in the summer in that grass. I'd go there at 6:30 in the morning and I'd hide in the weeds. And I was, I was 11, 12 years old. And I'd just to watch the horses run. And my earliest ambition was to be a jockey until I, obviously it was going to be too big. And I remember I asked my mother if I slept in a drawer, would that keep me short? She's used to remind me of that. So when I realized that I couldn't be a jockey, I thought, well, then I'll be a cowboy. And I was in the wrong place. But, when there's a will, there's a way. And I was on Long Island in New York, and there were lots of horses there. There was a lot of polo and race horses and jumping horses. And I was out in the country. And I found out that there was a famous rodeo producer named Colonel Jim Eskew. He was from Ardmore, Oklahoma, and his son was a world's champion trick roper. And he had another ranch upstate New York in Waverly, New York. And I got up there and got a job there in the summer working for Colonel Jim. That's how I got started riding bucking horses. There again, I never got to be any really good at it, but I sure tried. And I ended up riding, before I knew it, I rode in the rodeo at Madison Square Garden. I rode bulls and bareback horses there.
Wow, that's amazing.
And then I got serious when I moved out to California. But that's how I got started.
I read somewhere that you spent some time on a ranch in Wyoming.
Yeah, I did. But that was brief. And I had polio when I was a kid. And so I spent some time out there and some people that my family knew while I recovered from having polio. I was very fortunate.
Yeah.
I watched kids die in the same ward that I was in. Little kids.
Wow.
I mean, I fortunately I had lung damage, and which I still have. And one leg ended up shorter than the other by quite a bit. And that's what gave me a bad back, because I have a corkscrew for a spine, and I never wore a lift in the shoe, which I should have done. Probably would have done my back a lot of good. But, you know, it's never inhibited me from doing whatever I wanted to do.
Yeah, well, that's obvious. So you were rodeoing and when you were still living in New York, and then was it Hollywood that brought you to California, or how did that sort of all fit together?
It wasn't Hollywood so much. The very first time I went there, I was touring with the American Shakespeare Festival. We had a national tour out of their theater in Connecticut, where I had spent one summer season when it was a brand new, exquisite theater. And people like Katharine Hepburn had played there. And I did a touring company for 6 months, touring every city in America, train. And we played Midsummer Night's Dream and Winter's Tale. And we ended up playing at the Biltmore Theater in Los Angeles. And the star of our company was Bert Lahr. And Bert Lahr was a very famous vaudevillian comedian, was playing Bottom in Midsummer Night's Dream, which is a low comedy character. And I had become a real student of Shakespeare. I knew a lot about it. And I became determined that I would work in the theater as an actor. And Bert, I have since seen Midsummer Night's Dream performed at least 4 times, and 2 by companies in London, because I did plays in London. And Bert Lahr was by far the best ever. He played the lion in The Wizard of Oz, the movie with Garland.
Wow.
That was Bert Lahr, who played the cowardly lion. And he was brilliant as Bottom. And he and I became very good friends. And there was a movie done 100 years ago in which James Cagney played Bottom. And Mickey Rooney played Puck. And we were playing at the Biltmore. And Bert used to always a peek before the show through the curtain. He wanted to see how full the house was, because he had a percentage of the house. So he had a financial interest in whether it was full or not. And so this one night in Los Angeles, and he and I used to have dinner with him a lot because his wife couldn't travel with him. And I rode the train and Bert flew from one place to another. And so after I happened to be standing right next to him, and he and I were really friends. I mean, and the age difference was incredible, but he relied on me because I helped him in the early stages of rehearsal with his lines. There were things that he didn't quite get. But to choose him to play the part was a sheer act of brilliance on the part of the director. They knew what they were doing because he was brilliant. And this night, he comes away from the curtain and he said, "Good house, it's going to be full." And he said, "Cagney's going to be out there." And I said, "Cagney? Are you talking about James Cagney?" I said, "Yeah, he's a good pal of mine. He played Bottom in the movie with Mickey Rooney." I said, "Yeah, I did know that. But he's going to be there tonight?" "Yeah," he said, "he's going to be out there." He said, I'm going to have dinner with him and his wife after the show." He said, "You want to join us?" I said, "No, I'm busy." I said, "Yeah, I want to join you." And by God, it was just the four of us, me and Bert Lahr and James Cagney and his wife, Billy was her name. And we had dinner in the dining room at the Biltmore Hotel next to the theater. So that was how I first came to California, was in that play. And the director was a famous man named John Houseman, who directed many big movies, huge. He produced Viva Zapata with Marlon Brando. Anyway, and that got my foot in the door in Hollywood. I made friends. And I am right now, the book that I'm finishing, I'm very close to finishing, is going to be, it's a memoir. So all of this that I'm telling you is going to be in that book, and is in that book, because I've had an extraordinary life. And finally, people have been after me for years to write an autobiography, and I never was motivated, but suddenly I began to see the truth in the phrase that life is like a roll of toilet paper. The closer you get to the end, the faster it goes. And I realized that I'm getting very close to what could be the end. So if I'm going to do it, I better do it now. And I'm 98% done. I'm going to have it first draft finished by the end of the year.
Well, that is awesome. I can't wait to read that and to share it with the listeners.
Read it. I'm excited by it because it's really good. It's really good. And I am fortunate. I have a God-given gift when it comes to putting words on paper. I can write a lot better than I can talk. anyway.
Well, Alex, how did you make that transition from stage acting to getting into movies and more specifically the Westerns that you did?
Well, getting into a movie, what happened was I wanted to be in the theater. I did three plays in London, England, and was nominated for the Best Actor Award by the London Critics in 1960-something.
Wow.
And the nominees were Albert Finney in Luther and Christopher Plummer in Beckett and me in Play with a Tiger and one other guy. There were four nominees for Best Actor. And Christopher Plummer won it for Beckett. So that was my goal, was to be a serious theater actor. And I was very successful at it. And then back in New York, I was doing an off-Broadway play, a Tennessee Williams play, The Glass Menagerie. And TV was coming on very strong. And there was a TV show called Naked City. And it was a very popular show. Everybody knew. It was all about New York. And all of the New York theater actors got to work on Naked City. And I did. And that was my first time in front of a movie camera. Was on Naked City, and one thing led to another. And before I knew it, I was doing every TV show in New York. And then in those days, Hollywood would fly, all the good actors were thought to be in New York. So they'd fly an actor from New York to California to do a guest starring role in one of the TV shows or Westerns that were being filmed in California. And that was how I first went to California to work on film, was they flew me out there to do a show called Laramie, which was, there were tons of Westerns on TV. And that was a very popular one with Bob Fuller. So they flew me out there, and that's how I, that was my first part in a Western on TV. And Dan Duryea, who was a big, he was a star. And he played my father in that first guest shot on Laramie. That was fun. And then it just was, you know, a slow climb from there. I did a TV show in New York with George C. Scott called East Side, West Side. And I played a paraplegic in it. And in those days, you had, I got cast in that role 2 weeks before I had to go to work. So I had 2 weeks to prepare. Unlike today, they cast you the night before. So I went to a rehab hospital that specialized in paralyzed people. And I went every day, and I went through the rehab that real paraplegics were going through. So I learned how to operate a wheelchair as if it were an extension of myself. I could do wheelies with the wheel.
Wow.
Yeah, I got to where I could balance it on the rear big wheels and hold it front wheels off the ground, because that's what all those guys could do. So I learned to do it. You had somebody stand behind you in case you fell backwards. So I got really good at that. And at that point, I was not famous. So most of the fan mail that came after that performance, and George Scott was the jewel of all time to work with. He was just great. He's the guy who played Patton in the movie about the General Patton. Great actor. He was very generous with me, and he liked me. So I got a lot of fan mail afterwards, because that was the leading role in that show. And most of the mail was from paraplegics. They thought I was the real deal. So that was the mail that I got. I had convinced the world of paralyzed people who saw the show that I was a real paraplegic. So it's the best compliment I could get.
Yeah. And so was it after that that you got really involved in doing so many Westerns?
Well, you know, they just, you know, what was offered. It just turned out that way. You know, I did the remake of Stagecoach and played John Wayne's role, the Ringo Kid, in the remake. Wow. And that was one that just, they offered it to me. And I was hesitant. At first, I thought, man, this could be suicide, trying to fill John Wayne's boots, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, the New York Times did a 2-full-page story on me, saying the man who dared to fill John Wayne's boots, and went on and on about it. And anyway, it was a scary thing to do.
I bet.
But I had a great time, and it was a great cast. Anne Margaret was my leading lady. Bing Crosby was in it, and Van Heflin. Great cast, big names. Stephanie Powers, Mike Connors. So it was a fun thing to do. I had a great time doing it, and I got really good reviews, you know, because I didn't try to imitate John Wayne, or I just played it as, you know, I would any other role, you know, just try to find the truth in it. And I did most of my own writing, which was riding on the lead Stagecoach horse. But anyway, that's, you know, I auditioned for all of the TV shows, most of the TV shows that I did. But in movies, I'm trying to think, the only movie I auditioned for was Synanon. That was the first where I played a drug addict in a leading role. That was a good movie. Good movie. and again with a super cast. And I had the leading role in that, but I auditioned for that along with Robert Blake and James Caan. There were a bunch of guys auditioned for that part.
Wow.
Other than that, everything else was offered to me. And I always had other interests. You know, I was never dedicated to trying to become the biggest and most successful actor I could. I was more motivated in the theater. As far as Hollywood, I kind of took whatever I was offered, if it weren't, you know, obvious trash, and if the part was appealing. And then I'd go off, you know, after I had my first success with Cinnanon, I went to Africa on safari because I was so convinced. I was broke when I got that part. I had 150 bucks to my name. I was driving an old wreck of a car. And suddenly they paid me $17,000. I went from 150 bucks to $17,000. And I was so convinced that somebody was going to wake up and realize they'd made a terrible mistake and take it back. So I'm going to spend this, man. And I had a fantasy all my life about going to Africa. And I never dreamed that I'd ever have the opportunity to do that. And so, by God, that's what I did. I took that $17,000 and and bought myself a safari in Africa.
Wow.
My agent, he had a heart attack. He said, how can you possibly leave town and go to Africa? You got to stay here, man, and we got to capitalize on what on the success of that movie. I said, man, I'm going to Africa. And that's what I did, you know, and I did things like that, you know, and that's all in the book.
Well, that's awesome. I can just imagine what an amazing story it will be to read.
It is going to be a mess. You know, the best part of it is, I was telling a friend of mine just yesterday, in fact, that I think what's going to make it really work, I'm going to call it All True. And a friend of mine gave me that title, and he said, that's what I was telling him, stories. And I said, you know, when I tell stories about my life, I sometimes think, am I making this up? I mean, it's so unbelievable. How can I be, you know, did this really happen or am I dreaming this? And I said, but you know, John, the thing is, it's all true. That's the title for it, All True. So, my wife liked that a lot. So that's a pretty good title. I think that's what it's going to be. So you'll be on the lookout for All True early next year, hopefully.
Awesome. You know, I'm curious, because you were a part, you know, you were a major actor in the time that Hollywood really embraced the Western and the cowboy as, you know, sort of the iconic hero. And I'm wondering what you think about how that sort of shaped the general population's concept of what a true cowboy is, and whether you think that is really grounded in reality.
Well, you know, as far as the Hollywood, you'd have to pick and choose. I mean, I grew up on the Saturday matinee Westerns. I grew up on those. Every Saturday, I'd go and watch two or three of those Westerns. And, you know, I've seen every Western that's ever been made. And there have been some great ones that depict the cowboy very well. And some that are pure trash. I mean, first of all, if you think about Lonesome Dove, Lonesome Dove is a masterpiece.
And, yes, epic.
And it really depicts the life of a cowboy. Red River, John Wayne and Montgomery Clift, great Western. And that is very true to the life of a cowboy. Open Range with Kevin Costner and Bobby Duvall, great Western. as far as cowboys go. Mm-hmm. Open range is really good. I've seen it several times. And yet one of my favorites, which has little to do with cowboys, is a Western that Marlon Brando directed and starred in called One-Eyed Jacks. And it's just a hell of a good movie. But it's not telling the life of a cowboy. There are good ones. And I'll be looking forward to Tommy Lee Jones has got a new one coming out. It's a guy called The Honesman. It's going to come out pretty soon.
Do you think that we're going to start seeing more Westerns in Hollywood kind of come back?
I don't know. I don't see them coming back in that sense. But I think that there will always be the occasional one, you know, when if a great director or a big star like Jeff Bridges, you know, did the remake of True Grit. And, you know, guys like that who take and Kevin Costner take an interest and find a good story, you know, that a good Western will always turn up. But I don't see a lot of them being made. One of my books is called A Feather in the Rain. And I'm in the process of getting a movie made of that. And that's all about cutting horses.
Yeah. Now, and you wrote that book, what, about 10 years ago?
It's about 8 or 9 years ago.
Okay. I mean, it's a fiction book, right?
No, it's mostly autobiographical.
Oh, okay.
The whole thing about I lost a young son. I did. And that was, though it was not my first book at all, but it was the loss of him was the inspiration for writing that book.
So did you find that to be pretty cathartic for you at the time, writing the story?
It was, yeah. You know, I don't think there's anything more devastating than to lose a child. You know, we just don't expect that.
No.
And for a long time, I was paralyzed by the fact of it. I mean, I lost all desire for anything. I was almost literally hiding under the covers. And then one day I just pulled myself up and said, you got it. And I started writing about him. And then I realized that I could turn this into a really good story. And by God, I did. It's won the Glyph Award. They call it fiction. The Glyph Award, the prize it won was for best popular fiction. And, much of it is autobiographical, but a lot of it is fiction. Yeah. I mentioned Leon Harrell in the book.
Yeah. I'll have to check that one out too. That sounds like a good story.
Definitely. You like cutting horses, you'll love it. I mean, this one's it's all about the cutting horse trainer. Yeah. And the fact that he lost a young son. That, although I'm not a cutting horse trainer, that is the leading character in the book. Fantasized about that.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a good book to read prior to the autobiography you're putting out. Yeah. Learn even more about you.
Yeah, it's easily available on Amazon.
Well, I'll link to that in the show notes so anybody that comes to the website and listens to the podcast can check that out too.
Yeah, and the most recent book is called The Man Who Would Be God. And that is also available on Amazon. That's available on Kindle, printed version of it. The Man Who Would Be God is a very unusual story. And that is totally fictional.
That sounds interesting. I'll definitely link to both of those in the show notes so everyone can check them out. So, Alex, where is the best place for people to find you online if they want to learn more about you?
Oh, God, it's so simple. First of all, on Facebook, Alex Cord Author is the name of that Facebook site. And I never can remember what it's called.
Is it the Alex Cord News WordPress site?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
okay. I can find that and add that as well.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I can definitely do that. So I have one final question for you before we wrap up here. And I'm curious, what do you think is the most important quality for any good cowboy to have?
Well, you know, I immediately think of Ben Johnson because he was the quintessential cowboy. He was the real deal in every sense of the word. And I admired him so much. He was quiet, modest, extremely polite, and had great respect and reverence for human beings, and especially women. I mean, he could have written a book on manners, on how to behave correctly. And you know, everything was with him was yes, sir, no, sir, please, thank you, take his hat off. And he was humble, modest. You know, the fact that he enjoyed such a wonderfully successful career in movies never went to his head. He was always very modest, soft-spoken, polite. That's what I keep coming back to. And he was generous, giving. He was a kind man and just so genuine. He never had the feeling that there was a false note in him anywhere. And I had great respect for that. I think that for me is a good way to think of a cowboy.
So he was sort of like the quintessential cowboy that every good cowboy should aspire to be.
I agree. Yes. Yeah, that is exactly right. Yeah.
Well, that is a great way to wrap up the show. Thank you so much for being here today, Alex. I really appreciate it. It's been awesome chatting with you.
All right. Well, when the memoir is published, maybe we can do it again and talk a bit about what's in the book.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I've got some good horse stuff in the book, obviously.
Yes. Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you, Alyssa. Take care.
You too. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Alex Cord. What an amazing life he has had. You can find links to his books and websites and all the different resources we mentioned at earnyourspurs.com/episode12. And don't forget to go to earnyourspurs.com, click on the Cowboy Q&A tab, and leave me your questions. Thank you so much for being here today and checking out this episode of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I so appreciate you. You have no idea. Have a great day, and I'll see you next week.
For listening to the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Until next time, happy trails and spur on.